Hello and welcome. You're tuned into the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Beyond the Darkness. I'm your host, Dave Schrader. As we've done the show for the last 12 years, we've covered a myriad of different topics. I love to watch documentaries on the strange and the supernatural, and I'm thankful for all of the great documentaries many of you have pointed out for me to check out. That's led us to many of the best interviews and guests that we've had an opportunity to see and witness on this show. Now, with that said, there's been one documentary that has stood head and shoulders above the rest, one that has had me completely fascinated from the first watching. I think I've checked it out about 10 times now, the Afterlife Investigations, the Skoll Experiment. What a fascinating documentary. What an interesting look at the paranormal. And especially because one thing that we talk about on the show a lot is the integrity of an investigation, how experiments are done. And I was really intrigued and fascinated by the way the people involved in the Skoll Experiment focused and did this time and time again the same way to create a bridge, this amazing communication line that opened them up to some of what I think is the most compelling proof and evidence of the supernatural ever recorded. If you have not seen the documentary, shame on you. And I know many of you have reached out to me over the years saying, when are you going to do a show on the Skoll Experiment? Well, the time is finally here. Joining us on the air today, Robin Foy is with us, and his constant involvement in the now famous Skoll Experiment, which mainly took place at their farmhouse in the village of Skoll, Norfolk, East Anglia, UK, over a five-year period. 5 years. I want you to think about that. From 1993 to 1998, they continued this experiment. And during that period, Robin and Sandra were the only people in the world who were able to personally witness all 1,000 plus hours of physical phenomena in their Skoll experimental group. Robin, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're very welcome, Dave.
I know you've got an amazing bed of work that you've done since then as well, and we're going to cover that as the show progresses. But the Skoll Experiment, can you give us a little background, Robin? How did this experiment come to fruition? How did you guys start to line up to create this idea and put this to a test?
Well, in a way, it was a sort of long-standing thing. It's now 45 years since Sandra and I really began our investigations into the paranormal. And both of us started basically by joining a group, which was it turned out to be a physical circle. Two different circles, two different times, but we both went into it in the same way, not realizing, either of us, how rare physical phenomena is. We sort of started really in that area. We'd been doing it for many, many years, and we got married, both of us, second marriage, in 1979, from then onwards we had our own groups, many of them. I started a number of organizations as well, to try and boost physical phenomena and teach the world about it, basically, because round about the late 1980s it looked as though it was going to become extinct, because most of the physical mediums at that time had actually sort of died off. And there were very, very few of them actually developing mediumship, physical mediumship at that time. So in 1990, I'd attended many circles and been involved in many circles. I happened to be involved in a circle in Ilkeston in Derbyshire in the UK, where a message came through the medium, independent voice, which means that we heard it in midair, and everybody who was present was able to hear the voice. And it asked us to form an organization to boost and help physical phenomena to grow and become worldwide. And in fact, that's exactly what we did. And I started up an organization called the Noah's Ark Society. And in that society, we met and sat with many physical mediums. Some of them sort of became famous at that point, and some had already become famous. And we had the opportunity to witness many, many hours of physical mediumship. At that time, we were also looking to move, and we moved to Skoll in 1981. 1991. And from then onwards, we sort of got on with this group and gradually, through notices in the magazine for the Noah's Ark Society, we put notices in there to sort of say we were looking for sitters, and the right sitters came along. We had another five people joined us, so we were in seven in total when Skull started, and natural wastage ended up with us just being four people. And at those four people, we got the most fantastic phenomena in many different types of phenomena, which was has since been said that it's probably the largest amount of different phenomena in a group that's ever really been witnessed. And we got in touch with people in the scientific area who joined us and investigated us, and we were able to demonstrate the phenomena to them and to many other people throughout the world.
Now, Robin, there are a lot of skeptics around, and rightfully so, who question all of the claims of the strange and the supernatural. I'm a skeptical believer myself. I've had experiences, I've seen and witnessed things, but it doesn't mean I don't question the authenticity of a lot of these experiments and eyewitness accounts. When you watch the documentary on the Skull Experiment, there was so many things taking place on a regular basis for you guys. I mean, was there ever a day when you went in to make the connection, to do the sit, and nothing occurred?
In the Skull Experiment, no, that never happened. Once things had started to take place, it just carried on.
That's truly like you opened a conduit and a door, and once they knew that
exactly
you were going to be there, right, once they knew you were
exactly
going to be there,
it was a sort of door or a portal, yeah.
They just made themselves available. And was it always the same series of energies, spirits, entities that would come through? Or would you get a wide variety of different people?
Well, in fact, there was a spirit team that was working with us. We were told, rather like some of these organizations where you've got half a dozen people up front. But these were the sort of half a dozen people who were communicating with us on a regular basis. They were members of the spirit team, and they told us that this team was there. And between them, they were working out the different experiments they could do with us. And we were pioneering at Skull with a brand new way of working. The traditional way of working within physical mediumship was generally the fact that one person, one medium, would go into a deep trance and would sit within what was known as a cabinet, which basically was like a little Punch and Judy tent, where they were able to sort of exude a substance called ectoplasm, and this was then molded by spirit people into a physical form of a human being who was able to walk and talk amongst those in the seance. But that's not the way that we work. They were working with us in a brand new way, using only energy. It was safer, it was easier to achieve, and whereas in the traditional way, it could take anything up to 12, 15 years to develop good phenomena using ectoplasm. Using the method that they were working with us, it was just a question really of months to start to get good phenomena. And it was safer because if people in the past were working with ectoplasm, and there are still a few mediums that do, it was dangerous from the point of view that if somebody did something stupid in the middle of a seance, the ectoplasm that was in the room could literally shoot back into the body of the medium, cause them severe internal damage, and on the odd occasion, death. So that was nothing to be trifled with, but the way of working with energy was totally safe. If somebody did something really silly during the course of one of our sessions, all that happened was that the phenomena stopped.
And when you are beginning this in the initial stages, would connection be made immediately, or did it take a ramp up? Did you have to kind of turn the light on for the other side, and after two or three or four sessions before things started to really amp up, or did you begin right out of the chute making connection?
No, it was several months before it really started to come together.
Several months. And now you guys, explain to me the protocol. Would you meet every Monday at the exact same time, exact same place? Or how did that protocol get set into play?
Yeah, we started off by meeting once a week. And I mean, some people who wanted to join the group when we started off with seven people travel 70 miles to actually get to the circle. And very often they'd stay overnight and then travel back the next day. So, you know, it sort of it was quite an undertaking, and people really needed three basic things to be successful in working with the energies we did. First and foremost, every one of the sitters had to be totally committed to the task. Every one of the sitters had to be totally dedicated, both to the group and to spirit. And thirdly, each and every one of us had to be totally passionate about achieving the results that we wanted to achieve. And it just didn't happen overnight. So in the beginning, it was once a week that we were sitting. We actually started to sit in the December of 1992. And it was about May in 1993 before we got anything that was totally genuine, that we were aware was 100% genuine. And that really, all that happened on that occasion was that a trumpet, which I should explain is like a megaphone that sort of stands in the room, sort of fell from a table that it was sitting on. That was the first time we really noticed anything that was definitely physical.
Could I ask real quickly, how long would those sessions last?
Yep.
I mean, you went several months before you got something that was, in your opinion, interesting enough to really kind of elicit the possibility that something was going on. How long did these sessions last?
Well, we would sit for 1.5 hours to begin with.
So for several months, you would meet once a week for 90 minutes and do this. You guys, I mean, what fortitude. You know, a lot of people, they sit down for one or two attempts and nothing happens and they throw their hands up and that's the end of the story. Wasn't it a little discouraging after, I don't know, the first 2 or 3 months of nothing really occurring? What was the drive that kept you and your team moving forward, plotting one more try?
The fact we'd been able to achieve good results in the past with different groups that we've been involved with just kept us going. And we knew we were going to have to take a long time to get it. We were hoping that we weren't going to have to take the sort of 8 or 10 years that other people have done in the past. But in fact, once we started to get phenomena, it was made very plain to us, because two of our group went into deep trance. Now, there was no cabinet or anything there, but for every session after that, both of them, a husband and a wife, were totally in deep trance. And it was through them that members of the spirit team were initially able to speak. So, but in total, when we developed all of this, and the first proper phenomena happened almost after a year. So it was the October of 1993 that we got the first apport phenomena. In other words, a little present from spirit which landed on the table in front of us with a big thwack, rather like a house brick. And this turned out to be a coin, which is called in the UK a crown, very old coin, and it had the effigy of Winston Churchill on it.
Could we reel back for 1 second, Robin? When you said that you had these two mediums, this husband and wife team, that would go into this deep set trance, and they would begin this communication.
Yeah.
Again, right. for the listeners that are in the skeptical realm, how do you? What is the? How do I want to phrase this question? When you're witnessing something that you have no scientific way to corroborate, how do you know, and how are you comfortable enough to say, okay, what they're doing is real? This isn't their imagination. This isn't their creativity. This isn't just, their inhibitions released so that they're kind of channeling their own selves and their own belief systems and imparting them on you. as opposed to it being true spiritual communication and contact.
Yeah, well, that's, you know, purely and simply, we were looking for physical phenomena. And once they started to go into trance, and once we had the first apport, everything started to happen fairly quickly after that. One of the first things we got was spirit lights. Everybody present was able to witness this. And then we developed sort of five different ways.
Well, wait, can you explain for our listeners spirit lights? So yeah. Are you in a darkened room at this time? Candle lights, yeah. Total lights off. What is it?
Yes, we were sitting in a darkened room, totally.
And these spirit lights, would they go off like flash bulbs? Were they sparkles? What could you explain to us regarding what spirit lights looked like?
There were so many different types of spirit mm-hmm. light. They developed a little spirit light that would actually fly around all over the room, doing all sorts of aerobatics. They developed, because we were asked by the spirit team to actually supply them with a glass dome, which we did, and they used the glass dome to sort of store the different energies that they were using, and eventually also to sort of to light up the room, because they were providing spirit lights inside the glass dome, and on occasion they would rotate within the glass dome like a lighthouse. And when things really started to happen in the room, in other words, when we had teleported spirit people who were solid, then they could be seen by the light, the spirit lights that were present.
All right, now hold on. Again, to our listeners, I know this sounds unbelievable, but this was a large group that witnessed this. There were many times in many different places that people were witness to this phenomena taking place. Now, when you say these were lights, would they flash or would they be a constant emitting light like a torch or a flashlight going?
Well, all different types. I mean, okay. some were sheets of light in the room, so that it almost appeared as though one of the walls would light up. Other spirit lights changed color. I mean, we had a red. They tried using different colored lights. They tried producing red lights, green lights, blue lights. Eventually, they settled on a sort of greeny white light that they used.
Was it very bright? I mean, like once they would light up these areas, would it light up and illuminate the room enough for you to see each other clearly? Or was it like a self-contained glow where you could see the light emitting from the area, but it wasn't enough to bathe the entire room?
Generally speaking, it was sufficient for everybody to witness everything in the room.
All right. Now you've got this light, this light emitting. When you would speak, did you ask them how they were doing this and where this light source was coming from? I mean, there has to be an energy source to produce this. Were they emitting it from another dimension, another plane, or was the light an entity unto itself?
They did tell us as they went along, because what we were doing with the energy that was being used was a very much pioneering work. And of course, they asked us if we minded them going as far as they could with all the experiments that we were doing. And we always said, yeah, you know, carry on, do what you like. We're happy for you to carry on as far as you can with this. And then they would explain to us what they were doing. I mean, many of the spirit team that were working with us were actually scientists themselves who had gone over, had a life in our world, and then gone over to the spirit world. But they were still working as scientists. And a lot of this was all pioneering sort of stuff that they were doing. But the energy work that they were talking about with us basically involved three different types of energies. The first energy that they used was spiritual energy, which they themselves, the spirit team, brought with them from the spirit world. The second type of energy was the spiritual energy of the sitters who were in the room. Each and every one of the sitters was involved in this. It wasn't just one medium. We were all involved in it. And the third type of energy was, in fact, natural energy, which is in this world, and it occurs in naturally in spirals or columns in different places geographically. And these three energies were mixed together by the spirit team to form what they called a creative energy. The creative energy was stored then in the glass dome, and they were able to draw on this creative energy for all of the phenomena that they then developed.
So they were almost, it was like a generator. They were putting like a battery in place, and then they would draw from that battery in order to manifest and do the things they needed to do.
That was exactly it, yes.
Did you ever, I mean, there had to be a point at some point during this, because it, I don't know, maybe it doesn't for you. When I've witnessed unbelievable phenomena, and I'm witness to it, there's no denying what I've just seen. But then I stand back and I go, am I insane? Is this really happening? Were you ever questioning your sanity or the way the phenomena was taking place? I'm just curious. You guys were in such a unique position.
Yeah, I mean, we didn't ourselves, but quite frankly, I mean, some people who were very prominent scientists on occasions had the opportunity to sit with us, and they would witness the most amazing stuff. And then we had an occurrence that was quite frequent with visitors that came, which everybody would sort of call the morning after syndrome, when basically they sat back and said, yeah, you know, we saw it and it happened, but it can't be correct. just purely and simply because it's not logical.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, we did have that, but ourselves, we had total faith in our spirit team. They brought us a tremendous amount of personal evidence of their survival. They bring through facts that none of us knew. And then when the facts were checked, you know, they were proven to be 100% correct. From that point of view, the personal evidence showed us, without a shadow of a doubt, that life goes on. People say to me now, I've been involved in this 45 years, and people say to me, look, you've been in this 45 years, you must believe in life after death now. And I always say no. And they look at me a bit scant, you know, sort of, what is this, you know? And I simply say, well, you know, I don't believe in life after death. I know it to be a fact. And there's a hell of a difference between knowing and believing.
That's an excellent point. Was there ever sound that emitted when these energy lights would go? Would you hear a hum, a buzz, a crackle, any kind of noise?
In the early days, when we got the early phenomena and the trumpet sort of toppled off the table on the first occasion, we actually had cassette tape recorders in those days, and we were recording every session that we had, and we did notice. Just before the trumpet fell off the table, we did notice a definite crackle on the recording when we played it back. And as soon as the trumpet toppled over, the crackle stopped. So there's definitely some sort of energy that we were witnessing at that particular time. But we came to understand exactly what they were doing, and they would explain things to us as best they could.
When you would play back that audio, now I'm assuming you didn't hear the crackle or pop live. You only heard it upon replay, correct?
That's correct, yeah.
Would you pick up what we talk about as EVP, electronic voice phenomena? Would you pick up disembodied voices speaking on the tape while you were doing these sessions?
On odd occasions, yes. But, I mean, I when I first came into this 45 years ago, the physical group I sat in at that time was one where the guy who was the leader of the group had been doing EVP experiments himself for many years. You can actually pick up EVP from another person who gets it, like a common cold. And he and I actually spent many hours sort of experimenting ourselves with EVP. And I got to a point personally where I was able to get EVP by experimenting on my own, anything up to sort of 300 or 400 voices in 20 minutes on EVP. And the thing was, when I started to get more into the circles and saw things happening more and witnessed things and came across solid spirit beings who were teleported into the room, then I was more interested in that than I was in the disembodied EVP voices.
Right, and I understand that, but the idea that you're getting these voices, and again, for those of us in the field that investigate, to get one whispery voice is kind of an excitement. You were getting multiple hundreds of voices, a cacophony of noise that would come through. And it's interesting the way you pose that, Robin, that when somebody is proficient at it, it kind of passes on like a virus. So when you work with somebody, they become more proficient at it as well. Is that fair to say?
That's quite correct.
Interesting.
In fact, I've done workshops where I've got people who've never had it before and been able to demonstrate EVP to them with a recorder. And then at the end of the workshop, they're all getting it.
I'm curious, too, when you would hear these messages, and the only reason I ask about the crackling and the popping is we've noticed in a lot of the investigations we've been a part of here that there are times that sometimes prior, it's almost like a two-way radio or walkie-talkie. We'll get kind of this, and then the voices will come through. It's almost like a crackle and a pop, like they're pushing through some energy field in order to be heard. And I've heard it on multiple EVPs, from people all around the United States and around the world that have sent this to me. Is that because they are broadcasting from that side? They're pushing through that energy veil? What's your understanding of that?
I have to say that I've not gone into it deeply enough to understand exactly how EVP works. I only know that it does, and I've had many, many thousands of examples over the years myself. I can always get it now if I want to demonstrate it. But my main sort of interest has passed on, rather, from something which I know a lot of people put an awful stock in EVP, and I'm not knocking anybody for that. But we went way, way, way beyond that. And I think, really, the interest in EVP sort of fell a bit behind. I hadn't really studied exactly how it comes through. I only know that it does.
All right. I didn't know because, as you said, you worked with many different spirit guides and some of them scientists on the other side, if they ever were able to explain to you how that was coming through or what was going on.
We had, in our group, we had five different types of communication directly with the spirit team. Each and every one of those five ways of communicating with them was extremely interesting and just got more and more interesting as the experiment went on and the years went by. First and foremost, the deep trance communication was extremely good. I mean, I've witnessed hundreds of deep trance mediums in the 45 years I've been involved in this. And the two mediums we actually had working with us at Skoll were two of the best deep trance mediums I've ever come across in my life. And they were out for the whole of the sitting. And that's quite a sacrifice when you think about it, because for sort of 1,000 hours plus, those two guys just didn't witness anything of that. They were only able to sort of pick up what had happened by listening back to the tapes afterwards. But the evidence that came through the deep trance when we were speaking to these people who were members of our spirit team was quite amazing. And then the team started to work on what they called the extended voice, so that the vocal organs of the mediums in some way were psychically extended, so that the voices, it was their own, coming through their own voice boxes, but these voices could come right out of the walls. So they weren't coming directly from the mediums themselves. That went on for a while, and then we started to get independent energy voices that literally would carry on a conversation with us, and these energy voices were in midair, and they would sweep right round the room without anybody moving, and everybody present could hear them, and they could carry on conversations for anything up to 15-20 minutes at a time.
This is something I think we've referred to on the show before as direct voice phenomena. This wasn't something that you had to play back on recording. You were literally hearing out loud the disembodied voices. And it almost sounds like it sounds like Quadrophenia, the way the voices would move around the room for you, right? I mean, so it was broadcasting, so like each one of you could hear what was being said.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And some communicators within the spirit team got extremely proficient at this. There was a guy who had been an engineer in his lifetime who was called Reg Lawrence. And he got extremely proficient with this independent energy voice phenomenon, and he would joke with the sitters, and sort of jump from one side of the room to the other in a split second. I remember, you know, he was joshing with a number of sitters that we had when we were demonstrating out in Los Angeles, you know, he would actually touch some of the ladies. Just on the head or something, just to sort of say, here I am, I'm touching you. And then he'd speak from the other side of the room half a second later. Quite sort of amazing. But that was a very, very good way of communicating with us. Then they went on from that so that they were actually speaking through the amplifier of a cassette tape recorder that we had in the room. And we carried on a conversation with them through the tape recorder. They told us that the point of entry was a silicon chip. But we had people that came to us for a seminar who would speak to relatives in the relatives' own voices through this amplifier of the tape recorder. And sometimes, and I remember one guy, his relative who spoke to him, had only been passed over 6 weeks. So, you know, very early on in the spirit world, he was able to talk to him about things that only the two of them knew about.
And that's an amazing corroboration when you have that happening.
Absolutely.
Watching the documentary as well, it's one thing to hear these voices, to see these lights and this phenomena, but there was physical, as you said, apportations, things that would just kind of appear and drop onto the table in front of a group of people, everything from coins to antiques to newspapers. And that wasn't all. You also did experiments with undeveloped film, if I recall.
Yes, indeed. We did. Yes. Yeah.
And I found this really amazing, this kind of psychic photography that would be done. And you guys would take brand new rolls of film that it was freshly broken out of the package. Right. And you would set it in the center of the table, immediately develop that film to find that there were messages, photographs, and these messages, as you come to find, were coming from really remarkable resources, right? I mean, Thomas Alva Edison appeared to be making himself known during these communications.
Well, he certainly did. I mean, Edison actually put out a blueprint on one of these films that had not been unexposed. And when we developed it, on this blueprint was a picture of a small device that he wanted us to build, which he called the TDC, Transdimensional Communication Device. And he told us if we used it, if we built this device and used it, we would not only be able to communicate directly with the spirit world, but also with other dimensions. In other words, with ETs. Now, on this film, he actually signed his message, TAE, which obviously his initials, and the scientists who were sitting with us on the occasion that this came through got in touch with the Edison Institute and asked if they had any examples of his initial signature with them that they could copy and send on. And in fact, they came across a 1926 memo, which Edison had signed TAE, and they sent a copy of this back to the scientists who were sitting with us. And when they compared the TAE on his memo of 1926 with the TAE on the film in which he produced the blueprint, it was virtually identical.
Yeah, right. And that was part of what was so interesting to me too, is that you were getting this, and the information that you were getting was scientific in nature. This wasn't something that any one of you or your group had knowledge of, right? It's not like one of you was this electronics engineer and could have mocked this up or faked this up as well. This was something that was coming truly from a different mind.
Absolutely and totally, yeah.
And for a lot of our listeners, too, if I could just mention, Robin, here's a fascinating aspect, and we've mentioned it from time to time, but I'm not sure people really grasp this. If you go online, go to eBay, go to Amazon, you might be able to find Thomas Edison's original biography. It was subsequently re-released with a huge chunk lifted from that book that no longer appears in the biography. The original unedited biography includes an entire chapter on kind of spirit phone technology and how he believed that at some point there would be technology that would allow us to speak to the dead or the energy of the disincarnate. So this was a belief of Thomas Alva Edison that this could take place. And isn't it fascinating, Robin, that even in death, this was still an interest to him. This was, hey, if I couldn't do it from that side, let me help you bridge backwards.
Well, that's it, exactly. And I mean, the thing was that we did go on to build this little transdimensional communication device, and it took several months of working with it to get it absolutely perfect. But when we did get it perfect and we were able to get complete communication between us and disincarnate people, the very first person to speak to us through that device was Thomas Alva Edison. And he spoke to us through the device for 15 minutes. And we have a recording of that somewhere.
Now, has there been any comparison? Because I understand my listeners are going to be all over me if I don't ask the questions, Robin. Has there ever been any comparison to the voice that you recorded to known recordings of Thomas Alva Edison's voice to see if there is a match in that?
No, in fact, there hasn't been, because we've never allowed any of these recordings to be made public at this stage.
Why is that?
Well, purely and simply because we were asked to keep all of these things private until the spirit team wanted it to go ahead. But we have all the recordings, and we are hoping that in the not too distant future, when we've managed to sort of raise enough money to buy the center that we want, which is going to be all about physical mediumship, that it will be a sort of college in a way, and that people who are very interested will be able to study past recordings.
Don't you think that it would behoove the organization to release some of these audio recordings in order to garner more money and donations? I mean, if there was this kind of evidence that existed, I believe you would get more people that would be willing to participate and help fund this project and what you're currently working on, you know, as opposed to just, oh, yeah, we've got this and we've heard this, but here it is. Here we can lay it out for you. Wouldn't the spirit realm, wouldn't they want that to come forward to help this center and communication finally
build? Well, if they had asked for it, it would have happened. But, you know, it's being done in a different way, and there's going to be a totally different group working from that center.
All right, Robin Foy is our guest. We have to take a quick break. We'll be back. We've got so much more to discuss with the Skoll Experiment and beyond. You're listening to the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Beyond the Darkness.
Beyond the Darkness.
Hello, welcome back to the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Beyond the Darkness. I'm your host, Dave Schrader. If you are interested in the supernatural and the paranormal, and you would like to get out of your comfort zone, instead of just hearing about it on the radio, listening to it on podcasts, or watching it on TV, then I encourage you to join me at any one of the great events that I'll be a part of this year. Go to darknessevents.com. That's darknessevents.com, and get a chance to come on out. See all of the great places we're going to visit this year, where we will be investigating or hearing from some of the top investigators across the board of the paranormal, from ghosts to UFOs, psychic phenomena, and more. You can find all of the places I'll be a part of this year right on our website at darknessevents.com. And we have an adventure you don't want to miss. We're going back to Romania on our Dracula Stakeout Tour 2018. It is going to be amazing, and I hope that you'll join us for that. We'll be transporting around Transylvania and the surrounding areas, seeing haunted castles, haunted churches, cemeteries. We'll see the birthplace and death place of Vlad the Impaler, the original Dracula, plus visit some of the castles that he was associated with, and investigate two of those castles that are well known for being haunted. Plus, did I mention, we're going to take a visit to the Baisu Forest, one of the most haunted places on the planet. We get to investigate it at night. We get to walk through it. We get to see it and experience it for ourselves. So there is ghosts and alien interference known in that area. So be a part of the adventure with us. We're well over half sold out at this point. We're about 3/4 of the way sold out. If you're interested, visit darknessevents.com and click on the Dracula banner. You'll be able to join us that way. You can put down a deposit and make payments on this for the next couple of months till we're ready to go. So check it out and sign up now so you do not miss out on the opportunity of a lifetime. Today we're discussing Witnessing the Impossible, the true and complete story of the Skoll Experiment. That's the book by our guest, Robin Foy. Robin was a part also of the documentary, The Afterlife Investigations, The Skoll Experiment, which is by far one of the best documentaries on the paranormal and paranormal research and experimentation I've ever seen. For our listening audience, just to kind of catch them up, I know from the documentary, it almost appears you guys are in the basement of an inn or a bar doing these experiments, but actually you were in your home, which was adjacent to this inn. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's quite correct. A very old place. The farmhouse itself went back to about 1600 when it was built. And the Skoll Inn, which was next door, very old coaching inn, was built in 1666, the year of the Great Fire of London. There was, we think, at one time, a passage between the cellars of both the inn and the farmhouse.
I have to ask, too, when you're doing those type of experiments on a regular basis and you're inviting this phenomena in, when you weren't doing the experiments, would the phenomena still be there? Would you have things going on, lights in other parts of your house, voices, footsteps, otherworldly communication?
In fact, whenever you're involved in working in a physical circle in this way, as we have been over the years, once the phenomena starts to happen, you also get weird and wonderful things happening in your home. Spirits sometimes like to play with your electrics and your central heating systems and various other things in the home. For instance, there are many occasions when we would probably go into the kitchen to sort of put the kettle on and find that when you get there, it's already on.
Well, that was helpful at least.
It does happen, absolutely.
Right and proper spirits.
When we moved into Skoll itself, into the house at Skoll, there were actually three ghosts in the place. I call them ghosts, but they were actually sort of spirit beings. One of them was a dairymaid because it had been a working farm, and we saw her on a number of occasions. Another one was a big Irish wolfhound dog, who we nicknamed Rufus, and you could hear him padding along the upstairs corridor in the middle of the night. And sometimes when you were sitting in a room with other people, he'd suddenly growl, this very, very deep growl of this dog that, and we saw him occasionally as well, an Irish wolfhound. And the third one had been a worker in the farm itself. You would see this guy because the driveway into the house was quite long. And you would see this chap walk up, and he had what we would describe as an Andy cap on his head, a working cap. He would walk by the window in full daylight, and we'd often shoot out to the kitchen to open the door to discover that the figure had disappeared. So we had that all the time as well. Plus, Skoll itself had been an ancient Roman settlement that had one time been called Villa Faustini. It was the main Roman settlement between Colchester, which in those days had been the centre of the Roman England, and Norwich, which was another Roman place, and this was halfway between. But it was called Villa Faustini by the Romans. And whilst we were in that farmhouse, the barn behind the farm was sold off by the guy that owned it and turned into a dwelling house. And as they were doing that conversion, they found the body of a Roman centurion actually underneath the barn, which was then buried in the local churchyard.
That's amazing, right? I mean, to find an actual Roman centurion body or remains there, that's astounding. Now, with the experiment, you are getting more and more in depth into this. Your communication level is stepping up and seeing amazing responses and results. You're getting scientists that are coming in. Were there scientists that came in and witnessed this that would simply walk away and say, it's trickery, it's, you know, you guys are trying to pull the wool over somebody's eyes, or were they converted to believers when they saw what was going on?
Well, the three main scientists that investigated Skoll actually were senior members of the SPR, which is the Society for Psychical Research in the UK, and by nature, a very sceptical lot anyway. But the three scientists that sat with us on 25 to 30 occasions over 2 years witnessed all that was going on, and they were very happy to say in the report they did for the SPR that they felt it was 100% genuine. But they tried to bring in people like themselves who were what you'd call a closed skeptics. And these guys would witness it and then walk away and say it couldn't possibly have happened. So it's got to be fraudulent because that sort of thing could never happen. And I just sometimes couldn't believe the attitude of some of these guys who really were not sort of open to experiment at all, but were totally closed off. So that did happen. But we got to the stage that we knew it was genuine and we just carried on anyway.
Would they ever insert some type of protocol to make sure that, you know, were they the ones to bring the film? Were they the ones to do certain things and still get the results? Or were they unsatisfied because, you know, hey, let us have a little bit more control in this experiment?
No, they had as much control as the spirit team allowed them to have. And definitely they would search the cellar beforehand. They would go over it thoroughly. I mean, if it was a film experiment, very often they would bring their own films, and it still happened. The films were also put into a lock box, which they themselves held on occasions, and it still happened. So they were quite satisfied, and they put into place an awful lot of protocols, which proved to them that everything was 100% genuine.
And could I ask, was there ever any negative experiences that you had doing these experiments? Was there ever any energy that came through that tried to shut you down or dissuade you, you know, what some people would consider the demonic realm or dark energy? Did that ever occur, or because of the intention of the experiment and what you were doing, were you guys pretty pure on that?
It never, ever happened to us. It's never happened to us in 45 years of being heavily involved in this. All we've ever felt when working with these paranormal groups is love. That love is key to all of the communication between this world and the next. And basically, when you're sitting in these experiments, you could actually feel that love as a physical thing.
I love that you mentioned that as well, because I talk to people all the time that live in this state of fear where it comes to the paranormal. And aren't you afraid, Dave? Aren't you afraid this is going to happen, or you're going to get an attachment? And I can say, honestly, that in the, you know, 13 plus years that I've been a much more in active hands-on investigator, I've never had a negative experience like that. It doesn't mean that I haven't had maybe some energy follow me, but nothing that was ever evil or dangerous. And again, that's because I've just never allowed for that. The intention was to go have an experience, to witness the paranormal, the supernatural phenomena, and allow it to just occur as opposed to being frightened of it. Like you mentioned that you guys had this wolfhound that you would encounter. Here over in the United States, Robin, everybody would be sure that it's some kind of wolf demon that was, you know, because it was growling, it had to be evil. But I love that you guys kept it in perspective that, no, it's a dog. It's going to make these noises.
We always thought of it as a pet, really.
Right. And that's what I try to tell people with this show. We want to educate, enlighten, and entertain people. Take away some of that stigma and fear base around the paranormal and realize that once you get past that, that's where the magic lies. That's where the real experiences happen. And once you've opened up to that aspect, you become a conduit to really amazing phenomena. And you said earlier, you don't believe in the afterlife, you know. And there is a difference between believing and knowing. Believing Absolutely. Is still hanging your hat on an unknown. Knowing is confidence and faith in what you have experienced and understand to be true.
That's quite right, yes.
Let's talk more about the experiment, if you don't mind. Then I want to get into where you've gone and what's happened since the Skoll experiment. You did this over a period of 5 years. Why?
Yeah, we did, yes.
Why shut the door after 5 years if you were having this kind of, you know, experiments and experiences over and over? I would think that would keep people driving forward, especially when you're communicating with the likes of Thomas Alva Edison and was it Tesla at one point communicated with?
Yeah, Tesla has been involved as well. Yes,
right. Are he and Edison getting along okay on the other side?
Well, they are now.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good to know that, you know, old axes have been buried.
I mean, it amuses us in a way because,
sure.
You know, today, doing the work we do now, we've had a lot of communications from America, from American sort of spirit personalities, some of whom have been past presidents and some of whom fought in the American Civil War. You know, for instance, we have regular communications today from Abraham Lincoln, but we also have regular communications from Robert E. Lee.
And how does he feel about what's going on in America and all the statues and that part of history being erased or forgotten or pushed away into a dark corner?
I think, quite frankly, you know, the spirit world are rather worried about what's happening in the world today. And that's why they're trying to sort of get more and more groups to go forwards and develop this type of phenomena in order to help others to understand, you know, that somehow we've got to get this earth back on an even keel and in total peace everywhere.
That concern coming from the other side is interesting to me. Why are they concerned? I mean, if they're onto a new playing field, a new level, and they're doing things, why have a worry about what's taking place in the last grouping? I mean, here's the deal. If we drive ourselves into oblivion, that just means we're going to be joining them on that side a lot sooner. Or is that what they're afraid of? They don't want the waters polluted with the goofballs running around.
I'm sure they're not too worried about that. But the point is, if it comes to a nuclear war, and it could, that's a possibility, that would affect the spirit world as well as our own world.
All right. Good to know. They also told you that aside from communicating with ghosts or spirits, disincarnate energies, that you could communicate with aliens. When that trigger was tripped, what was the overall consensus of the group? Was that a shock? Was it a surprise? Or was it a moment of excitement and the possibility that we are going to go beyond what we even conceived with this experiment?
Well, certainly a moment of excitement. I mean, we were quite happy. Bring it on, you know. And not only that, but they did bring it on. We were able to, through this transdimensional communication device that Edison had sort of brought through for us, when we got it working properly, we did actually have the opportunity to speak to beings from other dimensions, ETs, into this whole system of the transdimensional communication device. They built a system that the spirit world called an Eidolis system, which was actually an interdimensional oral language interpretation system. So, for instance, an ET is not likely to be speaking English, but if the ET thinks into this Eidolis system, it comes out as robotic English.
Almost like a universal translator.
Absolutely, yeah.
And what would, now, were you communicating with alien life forms, or were you communicating with the spirit realm of aliens? Do you understand where I'm at, where I'm coming from on that question? I'm not sure I posed it properly.
Yeah, I'm sure exactly where you're coming from.
Okay.
And we did actually have a visit. First and foremost, we were able to capture some ETs on a video recorder, which was filming in total darkness. All part of the experiments the team were doing. And on one of those, they picked up an animated picture on the video recorder of a little guy that we call Blue, because basically he looked like the normal greys, if you like, but he was blue in color, so we called him Blue. And this little guy actually was teleported into the room on two occasions. He would stand in front of us, he picked up our hands, put them on his head so we could feel that he wasn't human. But again, there was love coming from this little fella. And not only that, but even after our experiments at Skoll had finished, we had two physical mediums in 2007 when we'd moved over to Spain that came out here and stayed with us in our house over here. And they did a couple of sessions for us while they were here. And Blue once again was teleported into the room. And once again he stood before us and allowed us to feel his head.
Physically feel his head?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. And would the communication between Blue and you be telepathic in nature, or was it an audible communication? Was it something that was recorded and could be heard?
No, it wasn't. He wasn't able to speak to us when he came, but he had spoken to us through the TDC system before he even visited.
The aliens that would communicate with you, what information would they give you, and what type of questioning would you have for them? I mean, I know what we on the outside are fascinated by, but would they speak to afterlife? Would they speak to the universe in its whole? What was the general messages that you got?
Well, they were basically working with the spirit team. So there was a sort of a dual thing going on. They were working with the spirit team and in conjunction with the spirit team. We didn't have an opportunity, unfortunately, because the experiment ended before we were able to go too far with these guys from other dimensions, with the information they were able to give us. But we did have visits by this little chap. Not only that, but we had a miniature UFO actually materialize within the room and sort of flew around the room for everybody to see. It stopped in front of everybody's eyes so that we could actually see this miniature UFO. That even had little sort of windows in it that were lit up. This happened on more than one occasion there.
You were just so calm about this, Robin. I mean, this is, you're talking, and I laugh about this on a lot of shows, but as an experiencer, you're talking about it like, oh, yeah, I drove to the local deli and got myself a sandwich, and, oh, yeah, I also saw aliens and UFOs and craft. But as I was saying, that sandwich was one of the best sandwiches I've ever had. You're just so kind of bland about it. I don't want to call it jaded, but I mean, is it almost to the point because of the amount of activity that you've been witness to that it's almost not as exciting anymore to witness this?
Oh, it's still exciting, but it's quite natural to us because, as I say, we've had this for 45 years and we're still trying to sort of work towards getting more and more phenomena again.
That's remarkable. It's what an exciting time to be alive and know that this is going on. If the spirit world and the aliens are concerned about our planet, Robin, and they want and concerned about humanity overall, Why don't you think they're at a point where they finally want you to release the information and prove once and for all that this is going on?
Because they have plans, which should really come into fruition later on this year, which will allow a certain number of people who are in a position to influence things to witness further phenomena.
Okay, so they have got something already in play that will start to open that door. Do you believe that then disclosure from the Skoll experiment and the audio recordings and experiments that you've done will become public at that point?
It will to people that that really want to study it in depth and in a serious way.
Okay, all right. Are these alien beings coexisting in the spirit realm with our ancestors and our people, or are they just mediumistic and psychic in nature as well, where they're in a totally different physical realm but they can sense the spirit energies?
That's something that I don't know too much about, to be honest. I mean, I know that it happened, that they were there was an intention for us and for the spirit world and for them to work in unison, but we really didn't get too much beyond that at that time. But I've got a feeling that we will be doing soon.
What can you tell us about the afterlife, Robert, to, you know, somebody like myself who has this overwhelming, and I hate to use the word, fear of death and what does or does not come next? As somebody who knows, what can you tell us that has been given to you from the other side about what we can expect when we do die? When our physical forms die, I should say.
Basically, when your physical forms die, you're simply going back home. The spirit world is our natural home. And the earth lives are purely and simply a way of teaching us, of educating us, of bringing us knowledge that we can't experience in the spirit world because it isn't a physical world as such. But there's absolutely no need for any fear. It is simply like walking from one room into another room, except the people you love behind, you leave behind, are obviously in deep grief. And you don't always, unless there's there is some form of physical phenomena available, you're not always able to go back and communicate with them.
Is there a sense of grief taken on to the next level? When my spirit leaves my physical form, will I grieve and feel the pain and loss of not being around my children or my wife or my family and friends anymore?
Initially, that's possible.
Okay. So as long as we're still kind of tied to that, even though we're no longer physical, we still have that resonance memory of it, that as long as that goes before we kind of transcend and evolve even further.
I that's exactly right. And of course, the thing is that once you're on the other side, most people who go over to the other side retain an interest in those they've left behind, in the loved ones, etc., and they continue to sort of to visit them, or even if they can't be seen.
I like that. I like that idea exists. Are we layers in a book? Really, the energy levels. You know, is Edison, you know, right next to me right now? I don't mean so much physically, but I mean, is that energy level just that close? Or is there a pretty big division line between our realm and what we call the spirit realm?
Well, no. The spirit world exists all around us. And quite frankly, it's exactly the same sort of space, if you like, as we are, except that it's not a physical world. And the reason that we're not able to perceive it is that the rate of vibration in the spirit world is finer than ours in the physical world, and that's why we're just not able to see one another. But it exists all around us all the time.
Can you tell us too, with this realm around us, when they're there, are they living a life very much like ours? I mean, is Edison still a scientist over there? Is it just like a video game? Are we just upping our powers and abilities and we're stepping into another form, into that realm, to continue the same journey? Or how does that work?
No, we all have a choice. We all have a choice as to what we're interested in, what we want to do. And there are certain people who have gone over to spirit who still retain a great interest in the world as it stands at the moment, and who want to help, because the world is in one heck of a mess, as I think most of us would agree.
Well, I would completely agree. You've done these experiments. What wound them? What was the end point? I know that there's been a lot of conjecture online that there was a falling out between the team, that egos got involved, and that impurity started to break down the communication. Can you either confirm or deny if that was part of what took place?
No, not at all. It was purely and simply the fact that the experiment was intended to be a pioneering experiment, and the spirit team always wanted to go as far as they could with the experiments, knowing perhaps that at some point it would get to the point where they sort of overran themselves and further work became impossible. But they wanted to take the whole thing as far as they could. And the simplicity of the ending was that each time we sat, finally, the crystals which we had on the table started to vibrate and started to screech, literally, so that both of our mediums came out of trance and couldn't get back into trance at that time. And eventually we learnt from one character who closed, and we think this guy was, if you like to call him, a Lord of the Cosmos. He actually communicated with us directly through the amplifier of our tape recorder, and told us this fella called himself Varun Heerick, which is the nearest I can sort of get to that. But he explained to us that unfortunately the screeches within these crystals were preventing the communication between us and our spirit team. And we learned that the problem behind this was the fact that there was a team, or there was a group very much like the Skull Group, but 115 years into our future, that every time we sat was somehow using what was known as a crystal probe to link in with us. And this team were trying to communicate with us. Now, they were physical and real, but 115 years in our future.
That is amazing to me, because I've been talking about that fact that I believe that more of what we believe the paranormal to be is kind of a form of time travel communication. And
well,
here
absolutely.
You are saying,
I mean,
that, right.
The spirit world will tell you that time does not exist. It's man's invention. And I believe personally that the past, the present, and the future are linked. And that is why sometimes you can communicate with somebody that's gone into the spirit world 200 years ago, and you can communicate with somebody who's on the earth 115 years into the future. But the point was that what they were saying to us is that because this group were 115 years into the future, if they had told us anything of what was happening at that time, 115 years into the future, it could have changed. And if we then told that somebody else what they told us, it could have changed the whole of mankind. So in fact, they had to close down the group. It was as simple as that. And we lost contact with the group. And finally, they said, you know, they were awfully sorry and they thanked us very much for what we'd done, but they had to close down the Skull experiment. And to us, it was rather like losing the whole of our family, these being the people we spoke to regularly in the spirit team, in one go. So we certainly grieved for a number of years after Skull finished.
Once you disbanded the group, was there still would you come together once a year or something just to continue that connection, or did everybody just go on their own separate ways and their own experiences and travels now?
No, at that point, we each went our own separate ways, and remembering that there were really only two couples involved in the group when it finished, the time was not right, and that was, although my wife Sandra and I have tried over the years to continue sitting and to try and get back the phenomena that we had, that just did not happen up until...
Why do you think that was? I mean, you'd already been...
the time wasn't right. We've been told since that the time wasn't right. What we have been told is that the time is now right, and that phenomena is beginning to occur again.
Where does this lead you now? Where in your life experiences are you, and what's the next step for you and your group and your wife and this team?
The next step is for us to get the center that Spirit wanted us to have and told us about 10 years ago, which is now currently available, and we've been trying to raise the money to do that. The thing is that it's going to happen. We're absolutely sure of that. And from there, there will be a core group who are able to demonstrate physical phenomena. And that core group will be called the Torcal Experimental Group. There will also be guest mediums come in there. For instance, the vice president of the organization we've started, the Spiritual Science Foundation, is a German physical medium called Kai Muger, who is an ectoplasmic-based medium who is probably the best demonstrator at the moment of ectoplasmic phenomena. Now, he also will be in a position to demonstrate. We will also be starting up a number of groups, helping those groups to develop, as well as demonstrating for other people. But the reason for the center is the fact that it will be a little bit isolated, and that will allow some people who probably wouldn't want to be seen sort of entering an organization like that, but who are in a position to influence mankind, to get the sort of information that will help the world.
Why in such a faraway place like Spain? Why not in England? Why not in America, which would seem to lend itself to easier accessibility and a much larger core base to draw from?
Because there is a portal. There's a sacred mountain just half a mile away from this property, and there's a portal on that mountain that will allow access into both the spirit world and to other dimensions.
And there's nothing like Sedona, Arizona, there's nothing else like that that would be conducive to a more populated market?
No, unfortunately. This is where they've chosen, and they've got good reason for it.
Okay, fair enough. I know our time is running out on us here. If people are interested in kind of reenacting the experiment you've done, do you believe that others can come together with a common bridge and goal to do an experiment like the Skoll experiment and get the same results? As you said, they're finally at a time where they feel, you know, the spirit realm is ready to start making that communication again. Could other groups do that and strengthen this army?
They certainly could. Many groups have done that. Whilst we were doing the Skoll experiment, the spirit team at Skoll literally dictated a booklet, 72-page booklet, that people could use. It's got all the information they need to start up a group and get phenomena. Hundreds of those have actually been taken over the years, and many groups have started to already get good phenomena. And that book basically is available from www.skollexperiment.com, and they can download it from there. And people are getting good results from that.
So www.skollexperiment.com. I'll add that link to today's podcast as well, so it's easier to find. I've also got links up to the Skoll Experiment book and to Robin's book as well on our site, so you can find that. Just go to the Killer Deals link on darknessradio.com, and you'll find all of the links for those books. Fascinating life and fascinating experiments and experiences that you've had. Is this, and understand the backing of this, but does it excite you for the next level? Are you looking forward to your transition point and making it to that next realm? Or are you like, you know, yeah, that'll be great, but I've got a lot more to do here first?
That's exactly it. I've got a lot more to do here first. And we've already been told that what we're involved in now will be our swan song. But I am looking forward eventually to getting over to the spirit world, going back home.
And that's great. We hope that for you it's a long, long time, so that there's a lot of education that can be made between now and then. What can you tell me about these type of experiments and the people that were involved, for people that are concerned about doing their own? Has any weirdness or harm befallen any of the original members of the Skoll experiment?
No.
So it's not like, you know, slowly one by one, you know, people have developed Alzheimer's or passed away or died strange or mysterious deaths. There is nothing to fear in doing this with the right intention.
Absolutely nothing to fear in doing it with the right intention and doing it in the right way.
And
if
patience.
Anybody just follows, yeah, patience, and anybody just follows the simple instructions and advice in the booklet, that tells everybody everything they need to know.
All right. Well, we will make that out and available. Robin, thank you so much for joining us. And what is the best way for people to keep up with you and the work you're doing and your center?
Basically, we are recruiting people as members for the Spiritual Science Foundation. And all it costs is €20 a year to join the foundation. And to do that, all people need to do is to send €20 via PayPal to the email address torcalero, T-O-R-C-A-L-E-R-O 25 at yahoo.co.uk.
All right, Robin Foy, our guest, thank you so much, sir. We appreciate the time and insights to this remarkable part of history. And look forward to catching up with you as things continue to grow. Will you check back with us on the show and let us know what changes or what new messages are coming through?
Certainly will, yes.
That's it for today, folks. Thank you very much for tuning in. Remember to check out True Crime Tuesday today as well. It is an amazing story. For many of you that remember this hit series Hogan's Heroes, Robert Crane, the star of that show, led a very unique and hidden life. That was exposed after his untimely and still unsolved murder. We'll be joined by his son, Robert Crane Jr., to talk about his father's life, his death, and legacy, and this unsolved murder. Is it truly unsolved? Does Robert Crane, his son, believe that the murderer still is out there, or does he know who killed his father? We'll find out about that and more today on True Crime Tuesday, and it's easy enough to subscribe. Simply go to darknessradio.com and click on the True Crime Tuesday banner. It'll take you in time, about 2-3 minutes to subscribe. $5 a month gets you 4 brand new episodes every week, or every month, I should say, a brand new episode every week. And it gives you access to all of our past archives. So for just $1.25 a week, you'll get access to the best in true crime talk radio. It's a great follow-up to the best in paranormal talk radio. Thank you for joining me here on Beyond the Darkness.